the awfulness for the sheep is that it's moving from a winter to a summer in conditions it wouldn't normally live in. So, I mean, there are many reasons why, and everyone who exports or travels with animals, of course, has been on notice for years about animal cruelty. But I think that this trade in sheep is a shame and a stain on our international reputation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Australian Politics Live. I'm Catherine Murphy, political editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm also the host of this show. This week, we're talking live sheep. My guest is the Liberal Susan Lee, who has broken ranks and brought forward a private members' bill banning the trade within 5 years. Now, I have to confess up front, I can't look at that most recent footage of sheep suffering en route to slaughter in the Middle East. I've been paralysed by it, in all honesty. It just guts me. As you'll hear in this conversation, Susan is being driven by facts and evidence in this debate. You're going to hear quite a lot of it over the next few minutes. But I confess we did both find ourselves on the emotional brink during this conversation. Have a listen. Susan, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure, Catherine.
So I want to start because my assumption is that lots of people who follow politics will remember you as a Liberal and a health minister and will think to themselves, why is Susan active on the live sheep trade? So let's talk a little bit about your background and why you have taken an interest in this issue.
I've probably spent more than half my life associated with the sheep industry. Although I trained as a pilot when I left school and later became a tax professional with 3 finance degrees, there was a family farm in the background, there was 5 years in the shearing sheds, and of course there's been 17 years representing sheep and wool producers in Western New South Wales. So I feel very close to this issue. I've always taken a huge interest in it. I've always defended the live sheep trade. I would say that I feel deceived and angry and bewildered, but also determined, determined to be a part of the change that is inevitable.
And you feel betrayed by the industry in what way? Let's flesh that out a bit.
Because I spent 15 years since the Cormo Express disaster in 2003, which many may remember was sheep that Saudi Arabia refused to take and ended up drifting and dying in the ocean before Eritrea, under my predecessor Tim Fisher, and a deal that he did with them actually took the sad remainder and slaughtered them. But I was right on the front foot saying we must keep this trade going, and I ran all the arguments that are now coming back to me, every single one of them. It's quite interesting. And I believed them passionately, but I suppose your time in politics teaches you that there's a lot of things that are said, but you have to get at the truth and the facts. You know, we're here as legislators and we owe it. You know, this is the big deal, not the little deal, what comes out of Canberra. So let's get it right. And one of the things I've been really interested in doing in my time in Parliament is not just speaking from the cuff and not just trying to twist people to a viewpoint because of rhetoric and emotion, but actually saying, well, these are the facts.
Okay, well, let's start with the facts. So what's going on in the live sheep trade that's motivated you to bring forward a private members' bill?
It's a trade in terminal decline. In the last 5 years, the numbers of sheep exported from Australia has actually dropped by two-thirds. There's 1.8 million sheep live exported, nearly all to the Middle East. 1.6 million comes from Western Australia. The eastern states have effectively phased out the trade because the demand in the sale yards is for sheep for local processing, both for the domestic consumption, but increasingly for the export market. Australians don't eat a lot of mutton, so if you see the export value of mutton, you realise what an important trade it is to Australia, and it's increasing all the time. So we don't have the live sheep trade buyers in the market in the east. And it is a West Australian issue, which is why the people who are contacting me that are upset and cranky are nearly all West Australian farmers. But there is a huge number of farmers from all around the country that have contacted me to say, we don't like it. If we can manage the transition, we know that that's inevitable and we have to get out of it.
It's interesting. So let's tell the listeners what your private members' bill does. What will it achieve? What are the foundations of it?
It phases out live sheep exports over a five-year period, so it sets an end date. The reason for that is that unless that end date exists, processors who would build capacity or improve capacity in Western Australia won't have the confidence and certainty to invest. I mean, that transition is already happening. We already process 3.7 million sheep in Western Australia compared to the 1.6 million that we export. So that transition is already taking place. I'm also proposing a three-month suspension of exports during the northern summer. Mm. The Australian Veterinary Association would like that to be 6 months. I would probably personally prefer it to be 6 months, but I do see that that would effectively close down the trade by stealth by saying, oh, well, we're keeping it open for 5 years, but meanwhile you can't export for half of that period. Mm. So my co-sponsors, Sarah Henderson and Jason Wood, and I settled on 3 months of the northern summer, the worst 3 months, because the interesting thing is you actually shouldn't be exporting during those months now if the regulations were followed, which they're not. Because the regulations say animals must have access to feed, water, somewhere to lie down, and not be subject to unreasonable heat stress. Well, we know the stocking densities don't allow that. And we know that that heat stress is quite predictable during those northern summer months.
When it's hot in the Middle East, it's hot. So
I grew up in the Emirates. I've spent a lot of time in the Persian Gulf. I keep in touch with people there. One of the ironies of this issue is that, you know, I love the people, the culture and the way of life in the Emirates. And I met the Kuwaiti and Jordanian ambassador at their houses recently. And, you know, we had a good talk about things that matter to their people. We disagree on this subject, of course.
Yes, yeah. How did that conversation go when it got to sheep?
Well, it's interesting because Jordan has phased out its food subsidies and takes much fewer sheep from Australia than Kuwait does. Kuwait is our main customer. But demonstrating the fragility of this trade, 70% of our live exports go to just two countries, two tiny countries, Kuwait and Qatar. And the trade relies on food subsidies. So the price and the demand is driven by food subsidies that those countries pay to their government-owned companies and their people. Unfortunately, the money doesn't quite trickle down to the poorer citizens, but it's valued at, I think, $600 million last year in Kuwait. We're not talking about small amounts of money. So the critical thing to understand is the economies of those countries is moving away from oil as the oil price declines. Mm. And they're looking for something else. Bahrain is a good example of what happened when the food subsidies were taken away because the government was running budget deficits. They can't afford them. What actually happened in Bahrain was that they stopped importing live sheep from Australia. It went to zero at the end of 2015. People think, oh, well, they would have got them from somewhere else. In fact, that's not what happened. They replaced those live sheep with chilled and carcass sheep, in other words, processed meat from Australia.
Wow.
So there was a substitution. And that substitution is going on in Kuwait. It's going on in Qatar. They've replaced nearly 50% of their live sheep with imported processed meat from Australia. So we're not talking about a new industry. We're talking about
boosting. Out of the blue. You're talking about, in essence, managing on a transition that's already occurring.
Managing it
as opposed to pretend it's not happening.
That's right. And farmers want to see what that way forward looks like. And I think that if they can, it will give them a deal of comfort.
Mm-hmm. What about Barnaby Joyce, who seems to have skated through? Well, there's been things written about his period because obviously he had this portfolio for quite a long time, but he doesn't seem to have sort of worn the lion's share of the blame. Now, to sort of make this less a reflection on a colleague and also because I'm genuinely interested in the answer to the question, it's sort of a way of me asking you, do you think that this is a regulatory failure, what's happening in the industry at the moment, or do you think that fundamentally this is an industry that is built on animal suffering because of the economics, not because people are dreadful people and want to inflict suffering on animals, but I mean, it's just not economic to do anything other than stock those ships to the absolute maximum degree and send them over and hope for the best.
You're correct. It is an operating model built on the suffering of animals because of the stocking densities and the need to transport during the summer months. And the fact that the regulations are not technically enforced, essentially as an exporter, you fill out a notice of intention, you tick the boxes, no one actually follows anything up. How can they? We have to remember that the supply chain is outside Australia's legal jurisdiction, in the middle of the ocean and in overseas countries. So anecdotally, one of the key importers said to a colleague of mine, "I don't tell you what to do with my oil, you don't tell me what to do with your sheep." Now, what that demonstrates is a mistrust of what we call ESCAS, the Export Supply Chain Assurance Scheme, because the requirements are that not only is the journey over there in accordance with our animal welfare requirements, but so is this the journey after the sheep disembark. And that's a very difficult thing to either enforce, demonstrate, or, you know, gain support from the importing country, because they don't see it the way we do.
Well, they have different cultural attitudes.
Well, they do. But I also want to note that under Islam, cruelty to animals, well, cruelty to animals under any religion, is abhorrent. And this was made very clear to me by the Kuwaiti ambassador, and I appreciated that. The conditions of the sheep are not halal. They are covered in their own excrement, and they are suffering, and that is not halal. In fact, the imam in Jordan changed the slaughtering process to stunning before slaughter, which doesn't happen in the other countries, but does happen in Australia, because he was able, from his authoritative perspective, to say this is not halal. So, you know, we've got some clashes of the trade, the economics, the money that's made, you know, the religious inferences, and much more. So for the population in these Gulf countries, to see that footage would make them, and I know has made them, extremely uncomfortable, because we shouldn't assume that they approve of the cruelty that we see.
It would make anyone uncomfortable, regardless of your cultural sensitivities, I think, or your cultural practices and custom and practice.
Exactly. And see, this is part of the horrible pun, the wool being pulled over our eyes by these exporters in this industry for so long, because the headline mantra of the live export industry is no fear, no pain. And they'll proudly demonstrate graphs that show they've spent 35% of their budget on animal welfare. But when you drill down, what does that really mean? Mm. It means that, you know, there's some training courses, there's some accreditation for stockmen. You know, there's something called a heat stress risk assessment model, which I really take issue with. So its trading name is Hot Stuff, and it's meant to predict the heat stress events. And Dr. McCarthy, in his review, quite correctly identified that as a problem area. One good thing he said was, we should stop using mortality, deaths, I just call it deaths, as a measure of animal welfare, and start looking at suffering. Because before the animal dies, it goes into a heavy panting stage and is in serious distress. Maybe it doesn't die. Okay, it's not okay. The other thing is that when the animals are discharged in these countries, the death rate sometimes doubles. In fact, I've heard of feedlots where the animals have died in their hundreds, if not thousands.
Because they're so physically depleted after the journey.
Because it's so hot. And to even put water, I mean, these are desert countries, to even put water troughs for the animals, you have to somehow find a way of getting the water from deep underground, piping it and keeping it cool. You know, in these temperatures, water will be too hot for an animal to drink. These are not the conditions for merino sheep to live in. It's the reason why we don't breed merino sheep in the humid areas of Australia, because the animal's respiratory system just can't cope. So Dr. McCarthy's recognised that. Now, back to Hot Stuff, the IP of this is actually owned by the industry, so it hasn't been independently peer-reviewed. But I always say about this issue, the average Australian has worked it out. You know, you don't need too much science and technical mumbo-jumbo around it. They've worked it out.
No, but absolutely, I think that's right. But you do need evidence. You do need facts and evidence.
And so I applaud Dr. McCarthy for saying, we have to look at welfare, not just deaths, and we have to build a welfare measure into the heat stress risk assessment model. But, of course, we haven't done that. We don't know how to do that. No industry R&D has done that. So we have to start doing that now, which kind of makes me pretty angry. We've seen this litany of disasters for 33 years unchanged through a variety of ministers and government regulators, and rightly, I'm not going to point my finger at any individual colleagues. I do remember sitting as junior agriculture minister in the then Agriculture Minister Peter McGoran's office, a man who I have great respect for, tears running down his face as he saw vision of cattle being slaughtered in Egypt and just saying to his officials, just tell me how I can stop this.
Mm. Well, it is the question. Well, I think Susan and I have got quite emotional. Good heavens. All right, let's get it together. Let's get
We can't be emotional,
no,
Catherine.
No,
because,
exactly.
Because we have to do... Well, I mean, the emotional arguments will sway some people,
yeah,
of course, and they sway so many people. But sure. my job as a legislator putting forward something very serious about an industry was to say, what does this actually mean on the ground?
Yeah.
Let's put our farmers first. I've always done that. Some of them probably not
may
sure
not recognise
now.
Yes.
But, you know, I think that the reputation of our meat industry is actually vital here. Because when some of these sheep are processed, they get re-exported around the region and labelled Australian lamb. Because the Australian lamb brand is pretty good internationally.
Mm.
But unfortunately, they don't have the same quality assurance that our
processing
does. Yeah. If you go into any AQIS accredited abattoir in Australia, oh my goodness, you know, you can be, and I visited one recently. I always like to see how things are done, best practice, and know that if we can get there with our processing industry across Australia, my goodness, we can hold our head high in the world community. So what we're doing is putting at risk 94% of what we do in sheep and lamb meat for 6% that goes overseas that we really have absolutely no control over.
Reputationally,
you mean. So it's a reputational risk. And the New Zealand farmers recognised this because in 2003, it was the New Zealand farmers who stepped up and said, we don't want any more. They had a very similar experiences with live sheep because obviously they were doing the same thing. And they said, we don't want to do this anymore. The reputational damage to our industry is too great.
Mm.
So I really, you know, in my conversations with our farm lobby groups, it's no surprise to understand that that's what I'm urging them to do.
Mm. What about the fate of your bill? I'll get to a discussion that happened in the Coalition Party room this week in a minute, which is no longer secret given it was widely canvassed and reported. What do you think the outlook is for your bill in terms of numbers in the Parliament? Do you think that it will get the numbers to pass? And if the numbers are there, will you and your supporters or your co-sponsors cross the floor in order to get this done?
I would never say I would never cross the floor, but I have given a commitment at this point in time not to cross the floor. And the reasons for that are very simple. I want this to be Liberal Party policy. I don't want to align my views with Labor. I don't want to give Labor a win on this. I believe that this is absolutely the right thing to do. Not particularly political, although everything becomes political when you and I
building.
Know that.
Yep.
But if I look at the range of people who've contacted me, they've come from all parts of the political spectrum. So I the hard yards are, there's a lot of grandstanding in this building, but the hard yards are actually what happens out of the public eye. So now it's up to us, as my colleagues and I who believe this, to push for the next step, which is for the bill to be debated.
Mm.
It should be debated. It's a really powerful topic for many people. It's an important topic for Australia and it's been introduced. So I think it should be debated and I think everyone should vote according to how they feel. I'm not calling it a conscience vote.
Mm.
But at that point, I believe we will see the Parliament at its best, as we have with the gay marriage debate.
Every time this happens.
With other issues that I've seen over the years. So I don't want to talk about it in terms of crossing the floor and giving Labor a win and all of that. But ultimately, let's see what happens.
And and you're certainly not ruling out crossing the floor in the event that it comes to that. Yeah.
Well, I never rule out crossing the floor as a matter of principle. And I've often been asked that, as we get asked by our pre-selectors and others in our community over the years, you know, would you rule out crossing the floor? It's a favourite question in Liberal Party pre-selections. My answer's always been the same. No, I'd never rule it out. By the way, I never thought I'd be crossing the floor on this issue, but I'd never rule it out. Because in the Liberal Party, it's something we can do. In the Labor Party, it's not sanctioned. But in the Liberal Party, it's something we can do. But if you were to talk to my constituents and they were to hear that I'd ruled out ever crossing the floor, they wouldn't like that. They want to see you standing for something. Even, you know, a Liberal Party member said to me recently, oh, gosh, Susan, you know, you've almost half convinced me. He's a sheep farmer.
Yeah.
You've almost half convinced me, he said. But anyway, I'm going with you because I can see how much you believe in this and I'm going with a politician who has conviction.
Hmm.
And I think people want to see that.
Well, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. What about in the coalition party room, just for people who didn't read the media reports this week, there was a substantial conversation about this with government MPs expressing different views, but certainly you got a very strong show of support, if not specifically for your bill, but certainly for the issue, and for the government to take notice of the political impact of people's concerns about this industry and the practical ones. Warren Entsch, I think, said, you know, we need a transition plan. This is, you know, made similar points to the ones you've made today. You know, this is in terminal decline. We actually need a plan. We need to do this in orderly fashion rather than stick our heads in the sand and wish it'll go away. So do you think that that would have come as a surprise, perhaps, to the Prime Minister? And do you think that you can springboard off that to build the internal support that you're talking about?
Well, Warren Entsch, overnight, putting something on his Facebook page, and I see in his local press today, has actually expressed those
signed
views.
Up. Yeah.
He said we need a transition plan. But he's also ruled out playing games on the floor of the Parliament, which I appreciate. So I think that there's no doubt in anyone's mind that all of us have received a lot of mail on this, whether it be phone calls or emails.
Well, one of your colleagues said to me, Nola Marino, who is a West Australian, the government whip and a West Australian, while expressing support for the live export trade, acknowledged that she was being deluged, and this is at the WA focal point of this industry, acknowledged that she was being deluged by negative feedback as well. I thought that was quite interesting, really. I mean, she's defending the industry stoutly, but also acknowledging that people don't like it.
That's right. And a lot of people are coming forward saying that we are threatening, or I am threatening, the entire live export trade. And I want to make it clear that I'm not. So a lot of the response is, well, this is a huge industry worth thousands of jobs and multi-billion dollars. And I mean, coming back to my earlier point, you've actually got to drill down to, okay, what is it worth and what would the transition look like and where would the value be added? And the numbers aren't quite where they're expressed to be. But the live cattle trade is probably bigger in terms of value. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that the sheep trade is putting it at risk. It got the shock of its life in 2011, and I was very critical of the pulling the rug out overnight. But I believe that if any of us members of the community went on a live cattle vessel to Indonesia or Southeast Asia, we wouldn't find it confronting. The animals rarely die. In fact, it's very unusual for them to. And the processing at the other end is, Australia has actually invested in the processing. So it's not that different from what you would see in an Australian abattoir.
Right.
And, you know, the skill level is lifting. Plus, the animal is moving in the same temperature zone. The awfulness for the sheep is that it's moving from a winter to a summer in conditions it wouldn't normally live in. So, I mean, there are many reasons why, and everyone who exports or travels with animals, of course, has been on notice for years about animal cruelty. But I think that this trade in sheep is a shame and a stain on our international reputation.
The Prime Minister suggested to you in front of colleagues this week that perhaps you might have taken this up with the Minister. Were you a bit surprised by that? I know a number of your colleagues were. They thought, well, one, it was above and beyond given, you know, I don't want to get into, because we're having a substantive conversation here, which I really appreciate, and I don't really want to get into LibNat's kind of, shall we say, complicated marriage, but a number of your colleagues I know feel like the Nats have hobby horses of various types all the time, private members' bills, interests they want to pursue. Those interests are indulged internally, yet a Liberal, in good faith, making an evidence-based argument, stands up, says, no, I'm exercising my rights here as a private and bringing forward private members' legislation, gets a smack in public by the Prime Minister. Well, in public, in the sense of in front of colleagues, a number of people I've spoken to have expressed this view.
Oh well, people have their views. The Prime Minister and I have been friends for a long time, and while there may have been difficult parts of that friendship yes. over time, I'm sure it'll continue. Look, I've had some positive conversations with the Ag Minister, but when I saw the terms of the review that was going to be commissioned, which was how do we keep the trade going over the northern summer, not should the trade
continue
during the northern summer. And when there were statements made by our leadership that we were not going to look at a phase out, then my only course of action was to argue for that phase out. And I believe the parliament is better when private members do this. It's, you know, it's not exactly the case that we are the government. I mean, the executive of government is separate from the backbench. Yep. It's one of the key tenets of the Westminster system. And it actually makes a lot of sense. So I strongly believe that the parliament is better when we have private members who speak out for all the right reasons. If you speak out for the wrong reasons, it gets a bit political. But this is not an instance like that. And I, you know, I have to keep going on the path that I've set. If I haven't, if you know, one thing I've learned from being in parliament for 17 years is that when you believe that you need to do something, you must do it and not take a backward step.
That a girl. We'll leave it there. Susan, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you so much for tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe if you like the listening via your favourite podcast app or iTunes or wherever you pick them up. Don't forget those ratings and reviews that are also helpful. Thank you so much, as always, to Miles Martignoni and his production team in Sydney, without whom this show just wouldn't happen. Parliament's still sitting next week and we'll be back with another episode. Until then, may Auspol be with you.